as between those that are Tomei, Ben Ho'oi HaTomei LaToho, whether, and also between birds that are kosher and those that are non-kosher. V'lois v'shatzu et nafshoi seichem, in order that you shouldn't defile your souls, ma'behemo u'bo'oif u'bo'choil asher tirmois v'adomo. So there's the pasuk afterwards, v'yisem li kadoshim, in this way you will be holy, you will be kadosh to me, ki kadosh ani Hashem, because I, Hashem, am kadosh. V'avdil eschem min ho'amim liyos li. It seems, the pasuk says, that this is the separation between Klal Yisrael and the rest of the world, the Umas Olam, is this concept centrally, is the concept of eating kosher, of being careful with what we eat. This is seconded by the Gemara in Bov Netziah, Daf Samach Aleph Amud Beis. The Gemara says the following: Debei Rabbi Yishmael, he says, the Tana Debei Rabbi Yishmael, the Tana Debei Rabbi Yishmael says the following: HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Ilamolei lo helesias Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, if I wouldn't have brought Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim, Elo bishvil dovar zeh, if I would have only brought Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim for this one thing, she'ein matamim b'shrotzim, that they don't defile themselves by eating shrotzim, creepy crawlies, insects, die, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, that in itself would have been sufficient. The dayenus that we say on Neil Seder, with all these things HaKadosh Baruch Hu, here, the Patanid Beirut Bishmoel tells us that the very fact that we eat kosher, that we're careful what we eat, this in itself, without any other mitzvahs whatsoever, would have been enough. That alone would have been a schus, great enough for us to have been brought out of Mitzrayim and for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to have performed all those nisim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu performed in order for us to leave Mitzrayim. And lastly, the Medrash says, Omar Barachia B'Shem Rabbi Yitzchok, Se'uda, a banquet, Osid HaKadosh Baruch Hu La'asos La'avodov, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will in the future prepare and put before his servants HaTzadikim, those who are righteous, Le'osid Lovoi, V'chol mi sh'loi ochal nevelus ba'olam hazeh, whoever was careful not to eat tarpus in this world, zoicha liroisoi ba'olam habo, will be zoicha to see and partake from this meal. And this doesn't mean a physical meal, it means a spiritual meal, ba'olam habo, in the world to come. Therefore, it gives me very great pleasure, and it's a great honor to call upon Diane Greenhouse, who, apart from his role as one of the Dayonim of the Beis Din of the Union, and is heavily involved in Dinei Torah, in other matters of the Klal, but first and foremost is the head, is responsible for the Kashrus of Kadassia. He's made a special effort tonight, as he made a chasna just last week. We wish him a mazel tov, and just finished Sheva Brochas, to especially make this effort to come along here tonight to give us a shiur on the topics, give us a bit of an idea, of an inkling of the burden, of the responsibility that there is upon those in charge of kashrus in nowadays times. It is far more complicated than it once used to be, and I won't tell you much because this is why Diane Greenhouse has come here. But today, with food chemistry as it is, with the world shrinking in as far as foods coming from all over the place, it is far more complex. The responsibility is far greater than it once was. With no further ado, Diane Greenhouse, thank you very much.
I think it says a lot. The charm of your rabbi, who was able to convince me to come and give the shiur tonight. We're lucky to have such a charming young rabbi as you have. And I hope I will do justice to the immense task that he's given me. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Kashrus as I see it, looked at from my particular perspective. I haven't come here to knock any other hechsherim, but I will try and explain to you how the Kashrus organization in which I'm involved, have been involved for the last 35 years, the Kedasia, how we set about. And before I tell you how we set about, I'm going to tell you about some of the complications which can arise. The Torah made a restriction on the consumption of chametz on Pesach far beyond virtually all other non-kosher foods. It's the only one of the foods which the Torah says, lo yiroi and lo yimotze. Not only you're not allowed to eat chametz on Pesach, not only you're not allowed to have any benefit from chametz on Pesach, but in fact, you're not even allowed to have any chametz in your possession throughout Pesach, which gives an inkling of how strict the Torah regards the prohibition of chametz on Pesach. It's not really for us to look for reasons or for logic behind the mitzvahs of the Torah. I'm sure your rabbi has explained to you that we find in the Gemara that the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, is compared to chometz. The Gemara calls it the Seor Shabisa, and it's the idea that one of the concepts of getting rid of every bit of chometz is to teach us to look for and to root out every little bit of the evil inclination from ourselves, and to resolve to be better people. But as far as the practical halacha is concerned, the first point to be said is, whereas all other forbidden foods become nullified by being mixed with 60 times as much of heter, one, for example, tiny drop of milk of non-kosher food during the year falls into a pot as a drip falls in, and we calculate that the amount of kosher food is 60 times greater than the non-kosher food, then it becomes bottle veshishin, becomes nullified because of being so small, such a tiny proportion. It does not apply to chometz on Pesach, where even the tiniest quantity cannot become bottled, it does not become nullified. And it goes even further, that if a tiny bit of chometz fell into something before Pesach, where the normal din or bittul would apply, and when it comes to Pesach, it suddenly reappears, so to speak, it resurfaces. The Gemara calls that Chizer V'niul. It's as if it was asleep and it wakes up again, it comes back again. So therefore we have to be particularly meticulous in ensuring that there isn't the tiniest bit of chometz in any food which is prepared for Pesach. As you are probably aware, today, the vast majority of kosher products, certainly outside of Eretz Yisrael, are made in Goyish factories. There are very few Jewish-owned kosher factories that exist, other than perhaps meat and possibly also fish. But there are factories which are exclusively for kosher products. In general, products are made in Goyish factories. Now, there are two ways of approaching it. One is to try and get to persuade the factory to go over to all kosher ingredients so that the product is permanently kosher. Or you get batch production of kosher products in what may otherwise be a factory which is not normally run as kosher. And I think it's comparable to bespoke tailoring, where it's individually made to measure for the requirements of the kosher consumer. And that is really what Kedasi goes for. In the main, they go for bespoke, in other words, batches which are made especially for kosher production, with, as we'll see later on, how we set about it, and of course to reach to the highest possible standards for the Mahadrin. I want to tell you an incident which happened to us very recently, which will give you an idea of how things can go wrong. You know, the Torah asks us, as we said, chometz on Pesach. Chometz, the Gemara says in Pesachim, the Lamed Tes, can only be made of one of the five types of grain: wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. Any one of those five, they come in contact with water, and they're left for 18 minutes, it becomes chometz. Any other type of grain is not chometz. Whatever you do with it, it can't become chometz. Chometz can only be something made from or containing one of those five types of grain. In their role as the guardians of the Torah, and where they were reminded, were commanded Asus Yogra Torah, to create fences around the Torah, the great Rabbanim 600 years ago, maybe 700 years ago, decided to extend the Isur of Chometz to what is known as Kipnis, to other vegetables which could in people's minds be confused with the types of grain. I should say at the outset that the Isur, this ban on Kipnis, on Pesach, was not accepted by the Sfaradish Gedolim of the time, and up to this very day, it's particularly marked in Eretz Yisrael, that the Sfaradim will continue to eat Kipnis and Pesach, which includes rice, odd vegetables and so on. They only restrict themselves to the five types of grain mentioned in the Gemara, and in the whole of the Ashkenaz world, the ban on using kidneys, hot vegetables, rice, and all other cereals is treated as quite a severe issue. The Shamachuma rice, it comes under the heading of a sosor, and if someone ignores that ban, he is considered as transgressing the law, the negative command that you are obliged to listen to the words of the Chachamim, and they sosor, you must turn aside. You will find many Akshayim in Eretz Yisrael for Pesach, come to this country as well, of course, and it says on it, La'ichle Kittius. So for any of you to hear that are Ashkenazim, it means they're strictly forbidden on Pesach. It's La'ichle Kittius. For those that eat hard vegetables and so on Pesach, the Rabbanim are sometimes lenient for children that, for example, have milk intolerance, young children that have an intolerance to milk. Therefore, need to be given soya products. One wouldn't give them chometz unless it was literally life threatening. But if we're talking about kidneys, then for children that would otherwise be deficient, have a major deficiency in their diet, then Rabbanim will, something for which you always need to consult a rabbi in the exact circumstances, that would be lenient on products made like kidneys for those that eat kidneys. Because the restriction on kidneys is only a late Rabbanan after the time of the Gemara. Obviously, it doesn't have the same severity as real chometz. There's no prohibition in keeping it in your house. And the method that one would use for kasher, to kasher equipment that had been used for chometz, would be much harsher, much more severe, where you would go according to the strict guidelines laid out by Parshas Matos, which is, we in the Kashas world, we live by that parasha, how the Kashas became Midyon, Achas HaKesef, as Azov, called Domash Yomu Ba'esh, Tavir Ba'esh, it has been in fire, has to be Kashas in fire, it is used in liquid, it has to have boiling water, and so on and so forth. All the DM of Kashering are very strict when it comes to Chometz, obviously much less so when it comes to Kidneys. So we have this factory, and it makes a product which sounds, perhaps I should just tell you before we go any further, that because it's not clearly defined in the Gemara what kidneys are, although the word kidneys appears in the Gemara, not in connection with Pesach, therefore there are different interpretations of what is, what is not a kidneys. For example, in America, the Gedolim in America in the last 50 years have allowed cottonseed oil as being non-kidneys. The letter of Republic was very firm in his conviction. He wrote a tshuva about it in his Sefer, that cottonseed oil is to be treated as kidneys. All Kedashia products contain only oils which are made from fruits rather than from vegetables. It cannot possibly be a shadow of kidneys. We have currently four types of oil which can be used. Palm oil, which comes from palm tree. It's not the same palm that produces your date, but it is a type of palm, it's a related tree. If you ever come across the word HPKO, that's half the palm kadroi from the palm tree. There's a palm oil and there's a palm kadroi, which are two different oils. Palm oil is very frequently used in biscuits, chips, that sort of thing. Then we also use walnut oil. We use olive oil sometimes, and when available, hazelnut oil. But mostly it's either walnut oil or palm oil. Primarily, in fact, palm oil is used for basting. So, one of the products which everybody likes to get for basting is chips. And because chips from raw potatoes take a long time to dry, so if you buy frozen chips, which besides saving you the peeling and the cutting, they've also been par-fried, they've been partially fried before they were frozen, and therefore instead of taking 20-25 minutes to make a batch of chips, all the children clamoring for more, and it takes another half an hour to get the second batch going, it's very convenient to be able to buy frozen par-fried chips, and will appear to be a very, very straightforward product to make kosher for the rest of the year. Very straightforward. We check, for example, the source of the oil, and some oil refineries will refine on the same equipment things like lard. They are to be avoided. We have an oil refinery that refined lard last 8 years ago, but it's never undergone a proper kashering, and therefore not accepted by Darcy, although nothing traitor has gone through for the last 8 years. But it's never had a proper kashering. Pouring water on every part of the equipment. Although, as far as the guy is concerned, that's pure vegetable oil, it's not accepted. But we have proper chef refineries that only have and only do refine vegetable oils. So the worst that they can be is that they are kidneys. They have rapeseed oil, which is a type of kidneys, not seed oil, not refined in this country, but corn oil, sunflower seed oil, which is kidneys, but it's fairly easy to cash it. So we can get palm oil, which is kosher Pesach, although strange to relate, oil often has tiny bits of coppers put into it, deliberately. One of the processes is adding citric acid, which can be made actually from wheat, although the proportion would be parts per million, very, very tiny parts. It has some, technically has some effect on the oil, but it can be made without, and of course it's being made for a Jewish source, you're not even allowed to put in one part per million. So we can get it made without any citric acid, or we can get kosher Pesach citric acid if need be. And we can get palm oil and a crisp and a chip factory, which is basically they take raw potatoes, they wash them, they peel them, they chop them up, and they run them through an oil bath, and they cool them and then freeze them. It should be very easy to kosher for Pesach. Get it clean, which it has to be anyway, clean much more meticulously than it usually does, put boiling water instead of oil, push it through the machine, boil it up, clean it out with caustic soda and all the rest of it, which is done anyway to clean it, have somebody there to see that it comes to boiling point, see that it goes over the sides, and it goes through a kashering, fairly easy process. Alibi. The tendency, the trend in recent years has been to try and produce what are known as oven chips, because people believe that oil frying is not the healthiest way to eat. Potatoes are not as unhealthy as the oil in which they're fried, and chips, particularly par-fried chips, have quite a high percentage of oil. The tendency is to try and produce oven chips. You don't need to put them into oil, you just stick them in the oven and then take them out. They're delicious, so they say. But the problem is they don't go brown. And people are used to seeing, although they are soft and they turn into palatable chips, because they don't go brown in the oven, unless you take the lid off and leave them for a longer time, they go brown on one side like roast potatoes. So the factories have a method of turning them brown to make sure that when you put them in the oven, they'll turn brown. In fact, the oven chips are even brown before you buy them. And that is, the method is to give them a nice wash before you start in a mixture of water and 10% dextrose. Now dextrose is a cereal derivative normally made from corn. Corn, I mean, corn, as in corn on the cob, which is kidneyous, but is not kidneyous. So, first of all, some factories don't use this process at all, or they have a separate line for it, but where it is the same line, then it will now depend on what the dextrose is made from. If the dextrose, in fact, is made from corn, which is kidneyous, then we have a fairly straightforward fashion. Now, as I'll explain to you later on, before we go to any factory, we try and check out as much as we can before we even start considering the product. We have correspondence, we make phone calls, and so on and so forth, to try and find out as much as you can. But at the end of the day, it's up to your eyes to see what's going on. And as I'll also explain later on, there's always a pre-visit. Before you have your actual production, you always have a senior member of staff to go and inspect. Now, this company assured us that their dextrose is of corn-based. Show it, you can see it, have no problem. And there are other ingredients. Just by the way, some factories use what's called an anti-foam. Then you wash the potatoes and you cut them up, you sometimes get mounds of foam shooting over the sides. Anti-foam can also be comets, but that's an easy one. They'll easily change to a non-comets anti-foam, not a great problem. And that's cold at that stage. So they assured us that this was a corn-based dextrose. We have in our office a database with quite literally hundreds of thousands of ingredients and what they're made from, the breakdown, who gives them a kosher certificate, what their status is when they're kosher Pesach, when they're kosher Hadrin. And the screen will tell us automatically whether the Hechsher is in date or out of date, when it's due for renewal. We have a vast amount of information on a computer besides having food chemists working in the office on a daily basis. We have a vast amount of information. We can check this out. They tell us that the dextrose from this company is corn-based. We press a few buttons, although I'm not computer literate myself, but we have someone who presses a few buttons and will tell us whether that information is correct or not. We have all that on tap, and of course it's being added to all the time, but we have already a database that is the envy of many other people. It's worth many, many, many thousands of pounds just for the information it has. Coming back to this factory. Now, let me say something else. One of the things that anyone visiting a factory on our behalf, on behalf of any kosher organization, we're always asked to see is the ingredient room, the room where all the ingredients are stored, besides what's actually on the shop floor, being currently produced. We need to know what else is made on the equipment, what are the various ingredients. And they say we don't have an ingredient room. There's the potato store, and there's the oil tank. The oil tank is a huge silo which takes at least 20 tons of oil at a time. And there's the fryer, and there's the finished product. There is no store because there are no ingredients. So my man went along to this factory, which had been previous years checked out by two other rabbinical authorities, both of which seemed quite happy, and probably at the time they were right. I'm not suggesting they were not right. And they showed him a pallet with sacks of this dextrose, exactly from the company that they had said, the source which he had said, and he said, "But where's your ingredient room?" So we don't have an ingredient room, we've just got more of the same. Some of it is on the shop floor, and some of it is in the storeroom. And then we can see it comes from the same company, it's the same product. Now I want to see it. I'm sorry, it's not the point. I'm wasting our time, wasting your time. But he insisted. As he looked around the ingredient room, he saw that some of the sacks looked different. Close examination showed that they were from the same supplier, but made in a different country. Mobile phone back to base. What is the status of the dextrose, not from, I think it was not from Holland, but come from the Belgian plant? And the answer came back is wheat derived. Instead of being corn derived, it's wheat derived. It's been used, it's been through the machine. Now one looks at the machine with a completely different eye. When we thought it was only kidneyous, steam cleaning would have been sufficient. But now that we know that it's had actual chametz, start again. So he went back and looked at the equipment very carefully, and he discovered that after the potatoes had been soaked in this solution, dextrose water, 10% dextrose, it sent on a moving belt through a hot air oven. Now I said to you before, the apostle says, Kol Tova Shiyovei Boeish, Tavilu Boeish. So what is the status of a hot oven which doesn't have any heating inside the oven, but it has air blown in from outside where it's heated by fire? Is that treated as steam, as water, or is it treated as fire? So put all that headquarters and then put heating. And anyway, they were told, we'll let you know, we'll consider before we, and that's the purpose of a pre-visit, an early visit to see whether the project is feasible or not, for the benefit of those that want to look it up. A long Shari Tshuva in Simon Tov Nun Aleph about hot air, what's known as a tunnel gorof, it's referred to there, hot air without any fire being there at the time. And we decided that such a thing would be libul, which is hot, a flame, a torch, a blowtorch would be needed. And they said, well, I'm afraid there's plastic parts in this. They're not going to withstand the blowtorch. And the project was called off. Of course, we informed the other rabbinical authorities that had used it in previous years. And they also called off their production at their factory. But it was only vigilance by our man on the spot and his insistence on seeing the identical product in the storeroom that brought to light that could have been quite a serious mistake. Now, I could give you many such examples, and I'll give you a few of things that can go wrong, do go wrong. Frozen vegetables, things like frozen carrots, for example. You don't refer to frozen peas, but you can get frozen carrot, which, as you would understand it, is carrots peeled, sliced, diced, or whatever you do. Frozen. Oh yes, of course, they blanch them as well. That's true. They do blanch them. Blanching means that they either soak them in or pour over boiling water over them. Some factories dip by pouring boiling water, others dip in boiling for a short time. It's not the same as par frying, it's not even par boiling, but it kills any germs that might be on them. But of course, many vegetables will turn black or brown very, very quickly. If you think of potatoes, you think of apples, perhaps maybe in the same factory. Many vegetables lose colour or they get discoloured very quickly. Best way of preventing it, as you all know, is a little bit of acid. You put a few drops of lemon and potatoes, for example, you don't want to go black or brown. And the one that's most commonly used is citric acid, or in the industry, is either citric acid or ascorbic acid, both of which can be kidneys, both of which can be chomets. Very commonly are chomets, which would mean that then the equipment in which they freeze everything has had hot chomets. And a big cashier before you could make, so if you wanted to make, you couldn't buy it off the shelf, although the only citric acid and carrots, because carrots don't discolour. But the equipment would have been used in most cases for products for which citric acid was used. Only this week, the company was trying to sell us a face of frozen diced apple. Frozen diced apple for use in a product. I know it's a bit late to start producing the face, but most of the stuff is made already, but it was a late arrival, and they assured us that it's nothing but apple, IQF, individually quality frozen bits of apple. We said it's impossible. Again, in writing, I said it's impossible, because the apple would go brown. Or you freeze it very, very quickly, so however quickly you freeze it, it'll still go brown. If you start going brown, it won't come out white. Well, yes, maybe a bit of citric acid. So it's still at this stage of the inquiry, but it looks as though it contains citric acid, and the product, I assure you, would not be used for basic. Now, some of the other strange things that have happened, that have come to light in recent weeks and months. We looked at some egg albumen. Now, egg albumen is the white of the egg, which is commonly dried and used in many, many products, many confectionery products, always assumed to be a perfectly glatt kosher product. We're the only proviso that the equipment on which egg albumin is dried is often used for drying milk. It's the same type of equipment which you make milk powder, which is usually a spray towel being usually at least as high as this shul. It's a big round vessel which has at the top a nozzle through which the product is sprayed, similar to an aerosol. It's sent out pressure, tiny droplets. Hot air comes from the bottom of the tower, and as the hot air meets the droplets, it evaporates all the moisture, and they come down as little bits of powder. Now, again, a question: how does one kasher such a piece of equipment? Does it need to blow that because hot air? And that's why most kasher authorities around the world do not allow kashering of a spray dry tower. In fact, perhaps you just set up a spray dry tower just for producing kosher milk powder. The demand in Eretz-Yisrael, it's in Europe, they're not in Eretz-Yisrael. It's in Europe, they have much bigger farms, they get vast quantities of milk in a short period of time. But they set up a spray dry tower, one of the big companies, which will be exclusively used or supervised milk at all times and nothing else, because it's a great energy in kashering. Spray dry towels. I could point them to look at albumin, we won't even look at it for face. But we have a feeling that some kashering authorities may think it's a good product. It transpired that it has in it both yeast, and citric acid added to it. In small quantities, but it is added. It transpires that the yeast is kosher pesach, believe it or not. Because most yeast today is not made from grain, it's made from molasses, which is a sugar byproduct. But the citric acid was hot. The yeast was kosher pesach, as it turns. I've got a tshuva from written by one of the rabbis in Switzerland, who says that he has a factory that makes yeast from yeast. In other words, the living organism is added time after time to new substance, and one produces the other. You make yeast from yeast, like pitzvah, yeast is made from yeast. They are natural. Yeast develops naturally, quite like when you make bread. But the easiest way, commercial making yeast, is making yeast from yeast. So you take your sugar solution, it's not sugar, it's molasses, which is the leftover of the living group, and extract all the sugar from the sugar. Canes, you're left with molasses, like a sticky, treacly stuff, and you add, dissolve it and so on, and then you add yeast to it, and it all turns into yeast. So he says for the last 25 or 30 years, they've only made yeast from molasses, but I don't know what the starter was. And the Gaon Avraham writes that for Pesach, even if the starter goes back 100 generations, if the original starter was chometz, you mustn't use it for Pesach. So he says nothing, for the last 15, 20 years, there's been nothing chometz in this factory, but I can't give it a hasher for Pesach, but I don't know what the original starter was, there are no records anymore in the factory. So he writes in his Hesher, his Kosher, and as far as Pesach is concerned, I'm unable to determine what the original starter was, so I can't give it a Hesher for Pesach. Two factories that I've sent somebody to look for recently, for smoked salmon, smoked trout, smoked fish of all types, which, well, one of them actually made an application to us to come under Kedasi, and they said 99% of all our product is kosher, but we do also smoke on the same equipment. They gave me a list of shark and a few other fish, which he knew were not in kosher, but he thought 99% was good enough. We certainly rejected that as a kosher factory. And more recently, we went to a factory and they told us that once a month they just do a few sausages in there. Okay, if you don't mind, if you do a few sausages in the smoker. Which of course was also rejected. Now we had a factory, which, a huge factory, I don't want to talk about what the product was, but it was a product which we desperately needed for Pesach. You all desperately needed it for Pesach, and the factory is so large that there is approximately 5 miles of pipelines. Now, pipelines in factories can be very complicated. Very often there's one central boiler that produces steam,
and it goes around all the various different pieces of equipment. And as you know from that very same passage, the fact that Torah requires kashering of vessels means that once you've got hot liquid inside a vessel, then the whole of the vessel absorbs even from the outside. A lot of milk falls on the outside of a fleshiger saucepan. You have to find out whether there is 60 inside. And as the rabbi would tell you, there's sometimes cases where you need 60 times 60. Sometimes it has to be 3,600 times as much in the pot as the drop of milk which fell on the side under certain circumstances. You sometimes even need 60 times 60. Anyway, so pipelines and steam lines are very, very complicated, and this factory decided to merge with their neighbors, which are making products with glucose in them, and glucose, wheat-based glucose. And we were concerned that the two are somehow connected. The steam lines go from one to the other. They tried to persuade us that this is made of this wheat for this. So I got hold of an expert on pipelines and asked him how long it would take him to work out whether this piece of equipment is connected to this piece of equipment. He said, if you give me two assistants, I think I can finish in 2 weeks. We've got 5 miles of pipeline to finish. And it probably nobody in the factory knows exactly what goes where. As far as the steam lines are concerned, obviously the product, they can trace where it goes. As far as the steam lines are concerned, it's almost impossible. And again, a factory which was rejected. We have sometimes problems in the air. AIR in the air. I remember we used to have a pepper mill. It's called the British Pepper and Spice Mill. It was somewhere between Dalston and Shoreditch. There used to be British Pepper and Spice Mill. For many years, Gadassi used to take their pepper from there. And when I took over in 1970, when I took over in 1970, I went along to this place and it was beautiful. Nothing but various spices, pepper, in the whole place. And then one year I come along for my pre-visit, annual pre-visit, and I find sacks of flour lying on the shop floor. I said, you know, flour doesn't need to be ground, you're a mill. What do you want? Flour in a mill, it's certainly not a flour mill. He said, the influx of the Indians and the Pakistanis, they want curry made here. And curry is too strong on its own, we have to add flour. But it's not, of course, added at the end, it's added together with the spices before they're ground, so that they blend properly. And I leave it to your imagination, if you tip sacks of flour at this end of the factory, and my hat would be lying at the 5 yards, 10 yards away at the other end of the factory, whether within a few hours it wouldn't have a layer of white on it. Flour, very, very tiny particles that fly through the air. And that was the last time he used that British and pepper mill for Pesach, because there's flour in the air. What can we do? That's how things go. We go look for other places. We had recently somebody looking at pickled cucumbers to be made. Pickled cucumbers is about the simplest thing you can get, and in fact if you use kosher basic acid and acetic acid is available, and kosher basic water, which shouldn't be difficult to get, and cucumbers and a few other bits and pieces of spices, it should be the easiest thing in the world to make. The problem, well, I didn't anticipate any problems, but I sent one of my top men to go and check out the place before we considered production. And of course, at the same time, he was looking to see if it would be feasible for Pesach. He wanted to make it for the rest of the year, and if possible, why not at the same time make it kosher Pesach? So what else do you make? Nothing. Pickled cucumbers, pickled cucumbers, pickled, pickled. Pickled what? Pickles, piccalilli. Can I have the recipe for the piccalilli? Yes, the recipe of the piccalilli contains 7% wheat flour to thicken up the sauce of the piccalilli. Fine. What happens to the product after the jars are filled? It goes through a pasteurizer, a sterilizer, to kill the germs. So it enters into a great big chamber, and there hot water circulates, and it sterilizes the product. How often do you change the water? You don't change the water. Will you change the water for us? No, you can't change the water. It's too difficult. So here we have. And then even if you change the water, you've got to cash on the whole piece of equipment. because it's been boiling. Of course, even if the glass doesn't send it through the lid, it would come through the lid. So here they've been using a product which contained flour, which was not anticipated. But we discovered that the product which contains flour, and if it cooks up in the same machinery with the same water, which they wanted us afterwards to produce, I suppose, yes, if you take a few lorry loads of pickled cucumbers, yes, they would change all the water, change the equipment, they would do, you know, depend on the quantities that you're buying. And that makes things easier, perhaps, for the American machine, because it has such a vast market, they buy in such enormous quantities, they have a bit more clout. We do, the quantities that we recommend is usually, we may often buy a few containers, but not always enough to persuade factories to make major changes or go to major cleaning procedures. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. So, I just mentioned at the same time that your soda water can be not kosher basa, although it's only water and gas. The carbon dioxide which goes into soda water to emanate is, in the south of England, made one way, but in the north of England, it's generally speaking a byproduct of either beer production or whiskey production. It gives off carbon dioxide, which is then trapped and used. That you can't get, if you go up as far as Scotland, you can't get carbon dioxide, which doesn't come from whiskey, unless you want to send it up all the way from the south, which is quite expensive. A product which costs next to nothing otherwise. So all these are some of the problems that we face day in, day out. So let me try and explain to you, actually one other one. I went to Catalyst many years ago to look at the possibility of buying cocoa from their place. And if you'd have asked me before I went there, I would have said to you, probably if you were stuck out in the middle of nowhere and you wanted something kosher, the place of a version shop, cocoa would probably be the one. I wouldn't have any shivers on it. And then a few others, but probably cocoa would have any shivers. Here I went to Cadbury's, a place called Jock, North Wales, and I discovered that they produce on the same factory Horlicks, which contains malt, which is a pure Hobbit's product. Malt is pure Hobbit's, made from barley. The product is heated through steam pipes, which is part of the steam system. And the cocoa beans, before the whole process starts, are put into a chamber and live steam is sent onto the cocoa beans in case they have any germs on the outside. Before they start all the procedure, they inject or apply live steam for 7 seconds to the cocoa beans. I was wondering whether perhaps it only us as the outside, because they clip them and then they take the shell off. Perhaps it doesn't affect the inside, it only affects the outside. But it transpires, they don't just shoot steam on them, but they put them in a chamber which is filled with steam for 7 seconds, that's enough for it to penetrate. And many of the shells are already cracked before they go in, so the steam is getting to the cocoa beans themselves. So we look for elsewhere for our cocoa to face it. We had to reject their cocoa because it was the same steam which previously had gone through pipelines which heated the Horlicks mixture, and then later on was sent live, not through pipes, live steam, that means where the steam is released onto the product. So, let me try and explain to you what we do to prevent all this sort of thing from happening. So the first thing that we do is, as soon as we have any application for a product to be made, we get as much information as possible from the factory. What do they make? What else is used on the same equipment? What kind of processes are we talking about? And we send emails, faxes, letters, phone calls to try and find out as much information as we can. If everything seems reasonable, it seems as though it's a feasible project, and of course this is where our database comes into use. This is where every ingredient that's been declared is checked up on our database to see what its status is. Is it kosher? Is it non-kosher? Is it kosher pesa? Does it have a kosher certificate? Is it sitting up to date? Is it the recipient we want to rely on? Or is it some unknown source? And so on and so forth. If the project seems feasible, then we insist on what's known as a free visit. In other words, a senior member of staff will go to to actually check it out. And of course, sometimes we make products in the Far East as well. Think about Chile and the Far East. But we visit alone, which may lead to the rejection of the company, can cost about £1,000. And fares and hotels and transport and so on and so forth. Of course, we try wherever possible to make sure that if someone goes to the Far East, it's more than one place. At the same time, more than one potential, but it has to be done. If the report comes back, and it's always a written report, which I will study, if the report comes back and all is satisfactory, then we move to the next stage. If there are any shilas, then I will look into the files to see, possibly to my memory, whether there's a precedent, whether we've had a similar shila in the past. If it's something new, then I will not take the decision, it goes to a panel. There are nine rabbanim that meet every week, each of whom has a vote, but has no financial interest whatsoever in any Kedasa products. He won't get a penny more if there are another 1,000 products on the shelf, and he won't get a penny less if none of them ever reach the shelf. So they have no financial interest of any kind in any of Kedasa products, and don't have any pressure to approve. And they will consider what's known as B'chayla Drosh, with a heavy head and a heavy heart, in all seriousness, whether this product is acceptable, whether it reaches the higher standard of 100, whether certain changes are required, what procedures are needed, what kashrut procedures are needed. If it's something which is not identical to a previous case, then I don't want the decision on myself. It's handed over to the panel of rabbanim that meet every week. And of every meeting, although it covers many matters, something like on average 50% of the 2.5 hours that they sit is spent on deciding kashrut issues. Of course, there's some weeks when they're done, and some weeks when it takes really all the time. But it's 50% on average of the time is spent on decisions on kashrus issues. If there is an approved method or the product is approved, then we in the office, well, it's not my job, but we in the office will then draw up a detailed, accurate description of every detail of the procedure and what our requirements are to be. That a copy of that will go to the company that is to produce the product, and they will have to sign their acceptance of all the terms and conditions before we set up a schedule for the production. That includes, as you know, kashrut can't normally take place in 24 hours, so the downtime, what needs to be changed, what needs to be cleaned, what needs to be emptied, what needs to be refilled, how long the kashrut is going to take, because they have to take into account how much downtime, that means non-productive time, they're going to have to waste. They'll say, well, we'll clean it over the weekend, you know, afterwards. Yes, but we want to be there in the kashrut, and we want to be able to inspect every part of the plant before we start, and we make it a condition that if we're not satisfied with the cleanliness, then nothing will happen until our shomer, the man on the spot, is satisfied that it is meticulously clean. All our shomer are told, if you're not 100% satisfied, you are entitled to walk out. You're not under any pressure, even if you got as far as the Far East, which is many thousands of miles, and the fares alone are nearly £1,000. If you're not satisfied that they're sticking to the letter of the law, the conditions that were laid down, and they're laid down to the finest detail, then you're entitled to call off the project. You will not be, not only will you not be told off, but you'll get a compliment for it. If you found something had gone wrong and you called off the whole production, although there may be financial losses, penalties and so on, it doesn't matter. If they haven't agreed, they haven't kept to their condition, you may walk out. Of course, when you walk out, you take all your labels with you. And when the production is finished, all leftover labels are destroyed so that the company couldn't use the labeling on any other product. It can be shredded before it goes, or if it's small quantities, you take it back with them for future production. No labels are left in their hands. So, in addition to that, we have two members, senior staff, whose mobile phones are on 24 hours a day. I'm not me. I don't undertake that. But I have two senior members of staff whose mobile phones are on all night, because when there are productions in other countries and making milk products that start 4 in the morning or 3 in the morning, and there can be a hitch, there can be a problem, there are people whom you can contact, and they have the numbers on them any time of the day or night. There's never a time when you can't get hold of a senior member of staff to ask a question. One of the things you should use to prevent. Now, of course, in a thing like a part of this production, we will get a licensee in things like in the Far East. He will say like this: look, let's set up all the production on the basis of the information over the phone. You send out your senior rabbi with as many staff as he needs for the Hashgacha, for the production. And let him inspect the factory. If he's satisfied, production will go ahead. If not, you'll get on the plane and come back home. I'd rather risk it that way than have to pay for the fares for somebody to go out. I'd rather take the gamble and send all the people out. From the letters we've received, from the phone calls, from the assurances, from the information we've got from other Kashrus authorities that have been there in the past, that it seems 100% okay. I'm willing to take the risk. You go out, take the shaman with you, set up the whole production schedule. If you're satisfied, fine. And if you're not, then you come home again. And our opponent have decided that's not a good way of setting about things. Because once you're there and you spend now not £1,000 but £2,000 or £2,500, then it all becomes what's known as a Hepsin Maruba. It becomes now a serious financial loss, and serious financial loss can lead to leniencies. So we don't allow decisions to be made under pressure. There's no such thing as a production without a pre-visit. And if the last time a senior member of staff has been there is more than 2 years, then there will be a new pre-visit to make sure there have been no changes in the factory, there have been no repeat. Now I'll tell you a story that happened. But you know, it's a number of years back, and you won't be able to trace who it happened to. It's nobody in this part of the world. The Kashrus Authority from a completely different part of the world. They went to a factory that was producing tuna, and they discovered, as is often the case, that from the offcuts and the waste product, they make pet food. Very commonly used. The parts that you don't want to eat goes to the pet food. So, as a sister company, they have next door. They are a pet food company. Now the pet food can't live entirely on the offcuts of the tuna factory, so they buy in offcuts from other factories, which often include meat products. So this biblical authority agreed with the company that once they're for the 4 or 5 days that they are running the tuna production, they will close down pet food factory, close up all the valves which connect the two, if there are any, which in this case there were, and clean down, empty anything that's in the actual tuna factory, cash it all, and start. During that 4 or 5 a week, I don't remember how long it was, of production, there'll be nothing happening in the pet food factory, because otherwise the two are connected, and you've got, as you said before, flavour in halacha travels a long way through heat. It can go through pipelines, it can go through steam, it can go all sorts of ways. And they agreed. And on the Tuesday or the Wednesday, the Mashgiach decides to go for a little walk, and he notices that the pet factory is alive and kicking. It works at full steam. Phoned up his head office, and they told him that they'd broken the contract. No problem, you come home. There were two problems. First of all, the company denied it. They said they'd never agreed. Because they hadn't put it in writing, it was a very, very important lesson for us. And that's why all conditions are put into writing before we start, and they have to be signed by a senior member of their staff, managerial member of staff, to ensure that they cannot deny what has been agreed. And they were left with container loads of stuff which had to be dumped at sea, because they couldn't scratch the name off. It was on the agreed tin, it had the hasher on, and they couldn't sell it anywhere in the world. Did anyone pick it up? Even in a Goyisha, can't believe someone pick it up. It's not worthwhile emptying out all the tins and starting again. They had to dump container loads of stuff. The financial implications, of course, were 4 times afterwards, but that's what happens. We had recently a production where something went wrong, which was not our fault. Something she bought in as being kosher the Pesach, and after a lot of production, we got an email saying they're very sorry, but by mistake they put a chomet stick ingredient in it, but it's bottle of shishim. They put it in by mistake. We had £200,000 worth of stuff that had to be dumped because of a mistake on the part of. I'm not saying we're infallible, we can also make mistakes, but this one was not our mistake. I'm not claiming infallibility. Nobody can claim infallibility. One of the things which we do, which we happen every day for success in the Wednesday, after all our establishments and after all our efforts, nobody is infallible. But of course we have staff who I would like to describe as being knowledgeable, dedicated, thorough, experienced, capable, sharp pair of eyes, very, very observant, articulate, good at dialogue, gentle but firm, motivated, unmoved by offers of reward or by threats. It's a physical threat. This will go wrong, this will happen, that will happen, and we will tell this one, and nobody will. We don't get impressed, we don't accept any gifts. And, above all, when our people inspect, and this time we've come across in America, where inspectors are paid so much per visit. Senior staff are paid so much per visit, and if they can manage to do 3 visits in a day, then they will get, $300, maybe not more than that. If they only do 2, then they get $200, which means that they're always in a hurry. And if ever it's been a joint visit with a member of our staff, they've always said, what are you rushing for? We are told, when you're going to a factory, don't look at your watch till you've finished. In the years gone by, when I used to do a lot of these visits, I often used to miss my train on the way back for 5 minutes, because I would not look at my watch till I've satisfied that I've seen every aspect. I don't want to feel under pressure. I would not look at the time. I don't want to know the time of the train back, or the train back, till I've finished my visit. Or I just give myself hours and hours to spare. But otherwise, I don't want to know what time it is till I'm completely satisfied. When I've finished, then I say, right, what time's the next train back? And that's how I teach my staff. They must never allow themselves to feel under pressure or trying to rush. They won't get a penny more if they do 3 visits in a day or if they get 2 visits done in a day. It doesn't matter. You take your time over it, and the main thing is that it's done thoroughly and correctly. So, we try our best. We don't foresee after the Shmaya. We don't claim to be infallible, but we try our best to deliver. As I'm sure other Kashrus authorities do. I'm not trying to knock any other Kashrus authority. I'm only telling you how we work. I know what I'm familiar with. I can't speak for other Hashem. I know how we work. And we do our best to provide you. You can understand yourself that all of this costs money. You don't have the situation which you have in America, where companies are falling over themselves to try and get an action because it opened up from a vast market. We don't have that here. There's a reluctance on the part of many companies to get involved in kosher, but Baruch Hashem, the kosher market is expanding all the time. Baruch Hashem, I've seen a growth probably tenfold in the quantities and the variety of Kedusha products in the last 30 odd years. And Baruch Hashem, we try to maintain the highest standards of the Mahadran to provide you food which is absolutely exact kosher both through the year and for Pesach. And I hope the few words that I've said here tonight has helped you to understand, as we said at the beginning, a peek behind the Hesher. They show you some of the things that go behind the Hesher, and I take this opportunity of wishing each and every one of you a Freilich and Kosher Pesach, and the Vanishim should always protect you, as your Rabbi said at the beginning. You should have the Kedusha in your lives, which comes from, among other things, of always eating nothing but absolutely kosher foods. And I have first of all been with Rabbi Siyat and Ishmael to remind Yarek Yom Al Rachdai many, many years to continue to lead this congregation to ever higher heights. The main principle about Yiddishkeit, let me finish off with a very short story. I have a chutzpah from South Africa, and South Africa is the breeding ground for many, many Baruch Shulim today. In fact, I have a son who teaches in Asameach, just came over for his brother's wedding, who teaches in Asameach there. He went out on a 2-year contract, he took a course in Oral Agola and Asameach in Yerushalayim, and then went on a 2-year stint in South Africa. It was natural to want to go there because that's where his wife was from. and he's been there now for 5 years. He finds it very, very rewarding. And one of these Bodhicittas, a lady from South Africa, met her first teacher many, many years later in Eretz Yisrael. And by now, you know, she's wearing a shekel and her kids hanging down on the side, pushing her around, and bless it. And she met her first teacher, and she said, thanked him profusely for starting off on the right. But she said, you weren't honest with me when you started off. You didn't tell me the whole truth. She said, why'd you say that? He said, in every other subject, you eventually graduate, you get there eventually. So the point is with Yiddish camp, you never get there. There's always a higher madriga, you can always get further up. So she said, yes, it's true. Which of course it is. There is no limit to how high. That's why we get the vision of Yaakov with the silhouettes of our generation of Yashmaima. There are steps after steps that lead higher in every aspect of Yiddish camp. One can always improve one's performance, whether it's in learning, in davening, in kashrus. In every aspect of Yiddishkeit, may HaKadosh Baruch Hu help each and every one of you to always be on the up and up in the ladder that reaches heavenwards and which carries on indefinitely. And you should all be zeichim in the system to pray up and kosh and raisach and call to.